I started moving more towards strapping. I just wanted to build something, my own thing, make it profitable, be my own boss, not have to be accountable to anybody.
With millions of books viewed every day, did you know that you wanted to build a technology company in the future?
We're very staunchly now, like, no, we're just bootstrapping, we don't need investment. It's funny now, all the VCs that reach out every week. Well, yeah, now they're like, no, this is great, we want to invest in this. And I'm like,
sorry.
Not now. I remember saying to myself, if this product doesn't work out, I think I'm going to continue this account as like my personal books. I felt a connection to the people I was talking books with.
I wanted to talk about team. You run a very tight ship, just three people, and you were a sole founder in the very sense. It was just you. What made you feel like, okay, I won't stop this side hustle?
We're super excited to have Nadia Odiayo join us. Now, Nadia is a CEO and founder of The Story Graph, which has disrupted the traditional book tracking landscape by creating alternative means by mainstream platforms such as Your Goodreads, with a real focus on community. With over millions of books viewed every day, I'm super excited to have this conversation today.
Well, thank you. Welcome. I'm so glad to be here.
You started Story Graph as a side project. How did you get there? Did you know it would become this? Tell us the backstory.
Wow. Okay. Woo, where do I start? So yes, I had a side project that was a companion app to Goodreads. So I used Goodreads from 2012. And there was one thing that I wanted to do in Goodreads that I couldn't do. And that was being able to have that I could either track personally or share with a select group of friends and basically track my progress through those lists on a pretty dashboard. And with Goodreads, you could either make your own private shell or you would have these large collaborative lists. And there wasn't that thing in between that I was looking for. So I started this side project that was just a companion app to Goodreads. So you would sign in using Goodreads, it would pull up your shelves, and then you could add new lists and see your progress. And essentially, because of other work and things like that, this project kind of never moved anywhere until the beginning of 2019, when I'd had a couple of founding partnerships that didn't work out. I had 4 years of runway because from one of those partnerships, we'd been building up a lot of money in order to invest in our own products. But I left that partnership. And when I did, I took 50% of the money we had in the bank because I owned 50% of the company. So that gave me five years of runway. And then I spent a year working with another friend. That didn't work out. So now I got 4 years of runway. So I'm thinking, the last two founding partnerships that I've been in haven't worked out. I've got 4 years of money based on my current spending before I would need to get a job. So I don't need to get a job. I don't really have any burning startup ideas right now, but I know I've always been entrepreneurial. I've always wanted to found something. That's partly how I ended up learning to code as well. So I said to myself, well, you've got these side projects that you've wanted to work on for years, but you've never, you picked them up, you dropped them. And there were two main ones. One was the reading one that I just told you about. And the other one was a running one where it auto-generated running routes starting and ending where you were standing. And the point of that, the idea for that came from, I'd been running, I got bored of the route around my house, the 5K route around my house. But two, when I went traveling and I was unfamiliar with the location, I was like, I wish I could have an app that I said, I want to run 5K or 10K. And I would put it in and it would just generate like a safe route for me. And you could even say like, avoid traffic lights or, you know, not too hilly, more flat, whatever it would be. So I had these two ideas that I'd been sitting on for a long time. And I just said to myself, just spend January of 2019 just working on both of them. Just don't put any pressure on it. See where they go. I was telling myself, I know I'd love to have like a startup and build something. Don't worry about that for now. Just work on your side projects and see what happens. So on the first Monday of January 2019, which was the 3rd of January, I sat down at my desk and I said, okay, which one should I start with? Because I can't work on both simultaneously. And I said, I'm going to start with the reading one because I'm a lot more excited about that idea. And I decided to go for the reading because I was much more excited about it. I was much more excited about books than running. The running one was more like, if this existed already, great. Whereas the reading one, I felt like, I've got to do this. And so I just started working on that. And just to fast forward to today, I essentially have not stopped working on that idea since that day. But to go back to that first week in January, I just had so much fun building this prototype of this idea I had. And from that week, I said to myself, okay, it might not be this specific idea, but I have to work in books. It was the first time I felt really fulfilled while coding. And so I showed some friends, like I did customer interviews with that prototype I hooked up. And I realized from those interviews that people were just like, oh, it's cool, but there wasn't a real excitement or a real need. And so I said, okay, if you're going to try and see if you can found a company within books, then you have to put this idea that you've already got away and just start talking to people, doing custom interviews without a product and just find out, are there pain points? Are there any issues? So I started doing that and I did that for 3 months. And essentially, after those 3 months, I ended up building, as part of that time, I ended up building like a personal recommendation service. Because the main pain point I ended up with was people struggled to find consistent high quality recommendations. Mm-hmm. And then the next phase of that was, okay, now I actually need to build a fully fledged reading tracker that helps people choose their next book. Because a lot of readers, it's not that they don't know any books to read. It's that they just don't know which one to go for next.
Yeah.
I would check in with people a week later and say, have you read the book yet? And they'd say, no, I mean, it looked amazing, but I'm going to first read this book that's on my shelf. Then I got this. And so that's when I was like, okay, I need to build something that helps people make the decision of what to choose next. We can maybe dig into this a bit more later, but I never, for the longest time, I never said I was building a Goodreads alternative for two main reasons. One was that it could become quite an intimidating thing, right? Like I'm just me alone at home. For most of the first year, I was completely solo. And to just say, yeah, I'm going to build a Goodreads alternative, knowing several people have tried before, it was kind of like, why do you think that you can do that?
It sounds like you were anchored on the problem. The excitement that you felt, the energy whilst you were building, it was some sort of signal to you. But then you also went and validated the problem. I'd love to talk about the transition from, I want to build this because it excites me, but I need to validate that there's something here. What were the insights you started seeing that made you feel like, okay, I won't stop this side hustle?
Okay, so there are a few factors at play in terms of me continuing to keep going in that first year. And actually, one of them was the founder product fit. So it was the fact that I just felt this calling to work in books in a way I hadn't, because there were customer interview rounds where it felt like there was nothing. And the two things that kept me going were I have runway. And so there's no rush for me to go get a job right now. And I'm so excited about working in books. So I will say that not all the research rounds in that first year were, yes, I have something. So that's what I want to start with. So I feel like I was very lucky with that founder product fit part. And then in terms of the, like in the interviews, why I felt I, so first of all, how did I identify that I didn't have something with the first one? I had read The Mum Test by Rob Fitzpatrick. And in that book,
our podcast.
Has it? Yeah. And in it, he talks about how to spot when people are just lying to you, or the types of questions. And I realized I've fallen into that trap because I'd essentially been going like, would you use this? Does this look good? And it's hard for someone to go, no, because they kind of go like, yeah, sure. But that's not a real test. That's not real validation. And so my number one fear, to more directly answer your question, Maria, in terms of that balancing that passion and excitement with actually properly validating, is I had this runway, and the freedom that this runway gave me, I was like, I can't imagine going back to a full-time job. So that was my fear. And I also founded products before, read a lot of startup books, read and listened to a lot of founder stories. All of that meant that I was very painfully aware of the danger of building the wrong thing. And also how you could end up building the wrong thing, but not realizing it until later, like trying to force it. So all of these things meant that as much as I was excited about building something in books, I knew the risk was high of me just building my own passion project, building something that wasn't quite right and trying to force it. And then in 3 years, 4 years, needing to go back to a job and having a product that coasted. So that is what made me be like, no, you have to validate this properly. And I was prepared to walk away if I didn't build something. I said to myself, Nadia, if you do these customer interviews and nothing comes up in the book space that's worth building, you have to be prepared to let this go. And so I went into it being prepared to let it go. So I would say less so than the actual customer interview learnings, which some bits of validation came later, like when I got my first paying beta testers. There were signs that, okay, I'm onto something here. Or when people would tell me, oh, I've deleted Goodreads or blah, blah. I did have signs in my interviews, but in terms of high level, I think it was more that I was prepared to walk away. And so I was just really analyzing it without like removing my personal emotions from it and setting up.
Got it. So it sounds like the runway really helped and you having time and also just, you know, enjoying it. It kind of sustained you enough to get those initial proof points. Because trying to build a book, you know, analytics or referral tool, at the time, you would have been like, but Goodreads exists, but there were gaps within Goodreads. I wanted to ask a little bit about how you got, did you have any entrepreneurial ventures before Storygraph? I understand that you had a publication before Storygraph, but I was wondering, like, were there any early signs that you would, because you were a coder, you were a builder naturally, but were there any signs that you would kind of lean towards the entrepreneurial path as opposed to the traditional finance?
So I'm laughing because you'll hear why I'm laughing like very shortly, because there's a bunch of stuff you said that is. So for one, I was not a coder technically. I was doing the investment banking track. I had a job at Deutsche Bank. I was going to be an investment banker. So I was your typical finance consulting. My degree was philosophy, politics, and economics. I was going into banking. I only became, and I didn't see myself as a coder and a builder because I won a competition. I won a couple of free places at coding boot camps and things. It wasn't by choice that I invested to learn how to code. It was more like, oh, when I won the competition to go to boot camp, Makers Academy in London, this will probably be smart for me because when I am an entrepreneur, like just using it as a kind of empty high level term, when I'm an entrepreneur, I'll be able to communicate with my developers. They won't be able to pull the wool over my eyes and trick me because I'm going to know how to code too. That's how I went into it.
But
so I didn't see myself as...
in time, did you know that you wanted to build a technology company at some point in the future?
So to go back, I always knew I wanted to start a company. My mom had been very entrepreneurial. She's the one that got me onto economics. I didn't know about that subject. When I went into sixth form, I changed schools. I did the international baccalaureate so I could take six subjects as opposed to your normal like four for A-levels. And so one of the subjects I chose was economics. And the summer before I started studying it, my mom got me this economics textbook. And I always remember the first concept I learned from it was the sunk cost fallacy. And it used this idea of going to a buffet all you can eat. And it was this idea of people feeling like, oh, I need to keep eating to make the most of my money, but the marginal returns are decreasing. In fact, it becomes negative and now you're uncomfortable and full. And this just stuck with me. And I was like, this subject seems so cool. So in sixth form, I also did Young Enterprise.
Oh, yeah, I did that too.
Yeah, and I was the finance director of my company. So I was always entrepreneurial, but I had no technical skills. And I remember when in my final year of university, I met Alice Bentinck of Entrepreneur First. And we had coffee and she said, yes, we run this thing called Entrepreneur First. And she said, having an issue with the women founders right now in that a lot of them are coming and they want to start stores or things that don't scale as quick as tech companies scale. And I would love for more women to be wanting to start tech companies because those are the ones that scale. And I think I'd always been more interested in tech companies anyway, even though I wasn't technical. And Maria, you mentioned that I had this publication. So I had a publication, a creative writing e-publication called The Storygraph that I ran while I was at university. And me and my friend who were running it, we had to rely on a technical friend who we originally paid for the first website, but it was a very, very discounted rate. And then he continued to help us. But I felt the pain of relying on someone else to make what were seemingly to me simple changes. And they were simple changes to a website. And so I just felt that pain, met Alice, who was also like, you know, women, we want more women, but women who want to start tech companies, always been entrepreneurial. And that's kind of how I ended up. I applied for Entrepreneur First. And when I got to the final round, but I didn't make it, but I had checked the checkbox that said, we are going to be piloting this coding course for women. Do you want to be considered? And they gave me a place on that course. And that was me starting to do tech. Like twice a week, I would go to London because I stayed working at my college in Oxford. So twice a week, I would go to London to learn how to code. And it was when I started that I realized the power of knowing how to code. And then I applied for the competition, the scholarship to Makers Academy. And that's how I ended up transitioning into tech.
I love it.
And day after, or not long after, I got the place at the coding course, but also my college at Oxford had emailed me to say, do you want to stay behind in the summer and work on this website for 12 to 16 year olds to get them starting to think early about applying to the best universities in the country? And they almost didn't email me because they said, oh, Nadia would be the ideal candidate, but she's already got a job, hasn't she? She's already covered. And they almost didn't email me. But I got placed at that coding course, Code for First Girls. And then the next day I got the email and I just said, I'm going to spend, this is kind of scary for me, who's so like planned and whatever, but I'm going to turn down the Deutsche Bank job and I'm going to spend 3 months doing this internship and going twice a week to London, and we'll see what happens. Okay. And it worked out. It worked out.
And see what happened. Yeah, it's so funny how that is such a nexus moment in your life, but you probably couldn't have predicted it. I wanted to talk about team and co-founder partnerships. You run a very tight ship, just three people from what I understand. And you were a solo founder in the very sense. It was just you running this amazing growing product and company for a while. You mentioned that some partnerships didn't work out. Are there any learnings from that? Right, figuring out those first person, you know, that first team you work with to getting your product from zero to one. What are the learnings you've worked, what's worked for you and your partner right now, Rob, on the team? Like, what have you learned?
I remember.
That's the question.
So the second partnership that didn't work out was actually with the wife. Yeah, with the wife of Rob. So my friend Saron, right? And before that, it was a colleague from Pivotal. And I remember a conversation after the partnership with Saron fell apart. I remember a conversation I had with a friend, Adam Cuppy, at a conference. We were in Australia. This was beginning of 2019, actually. So I was beginning of 2019, February. And he said to me, this was his theory on the difference between romantic relationships and business relationships. Because he said, people always say business relationships are like a marriage. And I disagree. This is what he said to me. And he said, I think that with romantic relationships, the focus is on the partnership, the duo, like you staying tight across, you know, everything else. And you're the unit that whatever you're tackling, whether it's the work thing, whether it's having kids, whatever it is, it's like you are a unit together and then you approach your challenge or whatever you're doing your day to day. And he said, I think business partnerships are different and they should be different. I think that when you've got a business partnership that works well, it's because there's this goal that's over here on the other side and you both have a similar vision of how you move that boulder, if that makes sense. And so when he said this, I realized that with the two partnerships that I had had before that didn't work out, the focus was very much, at least in my mind, and I also think with the other parties too, was very much on our partnership. And we weren't necessarily aligned on a product or a vision of a company, but we were like, this is a really great partnership. So when certain things came up, it was, and things were struggling, it was because there wasn't a unified vision or a particular product and how we were going to build a company or grow. It was more like, we're the partnership. And I think with Rob, although we're super close friends now and we have an excellent partnership because of all the years of working together, when it started, it was just like, okay, this is a vision of a company and what type of company do you want to build? And we're aligned. We're aligned on the type of company we want to build. We're aligned on our ambition levels. We're aligned on so many things. And that just means that the partnership just works. The other thing is the division of responsibilities. It's very on my roles and responsibilities. And he has a very limited realm, which is mainly to do with the AI machine learning and the infrastructure. And obviously he is a business partner. So he helps me with some business admin and decisions and things like that. But ultimately I have the main responsibility in terms of business day to day, then the app and web development and all that kind of stuff. So those, I guess the two key learnings, it's more important to be aligned on how you want to build a company, the kind of company you want to build and what the product is. And then the other thing is just clear lines of responsibility and to sticking to them and trusting that the other person's going to have their side handled.
Love that. And I guess practically speaking, how do you assess that alignment in mission and vision and so on? Because very early on, sometimes that can be quite difficult to assess. So how do you go about doing that for anyone that's listening?
Regular check-ins at different intervals. So in the first, before Rob came on officially as a co-founder, we had questions of like, okay, how do you see, one of the first questions he asked me before he was considering quitting his job is, how do you see me? Do you see me as a partner or do you see me as a CTO or like, you know what I mean? Where do you see me? So we had those initial conversations. But then it was also like, okay, what type of company do you want to build? Are you trying to build it really fast? Are you trying to get investment? I, at the time, was manually doing personal recommendations for people. And we spoke about, okay, if we scale this out, do we like the idea of a company where we're hiring dozens of people to also do personal recommendations? And we were both like, no way. So we were both aligned on, okay, we want to do as much tech as possible. So those kind of things. And then, you know, at the beginning of every year, we'll do our new year reflections and like, okay, what's the goals for this year? I have this prompt that's like, what do we want to be saying on January 1st, current year plus one? On the other end of the scale, we have a weekly retrospective, which is something I picked up from working at Pivotal. So every week, it's like, what went well this week? What didn't go so well? What do we want to talk about? And they can be anything from company things to interpersonal things.
Right.
So if we feel like a certain type of communication didn't go down well, if there's a problem, a performance issue on the product that's just not being fixed, complaints, any type of saga or issue. So I would say that's how we make sure we're in sync all the time, because we have
these check-ins.
We have a monthly team meeting. Mm-hmm. There's no need for a weekly team one. So we have a monthly team meeting, which is a great way for the monthly goals. Rob and I have a weekly meeting, but we're talking every day anyway, but we have that weekly structure still. And then annually, both with the team and then also with just Rob, we look at where we want to go and where we're headed. And that would be a great time. Mm-hmm. So if you see someone put something on the board that's like, hire 20 people, you know, I don't know what it would be. That's when you would start to sense like, I'm not down for that. So let's talk about that. But Rob's always pitching ideas. That's the other thing. Rob's always pitching ideas to me about certain things, certain approaches. And we'll talk about it. And I think, again, that's a great way of seeing where someone thinks the business is going to go. But also, if I say, oh, no, because of this, it's twofold. One is, oh, yes, I understand that reasoning. And yes, we don't want to build that type of company. But it's also ultimately, Nadia, you have the executive decision-making ability.
Right.
Even if I disagreed with you, that sometimes we have to make a call and you would be the one to make that final call. But like almost 100% of the time, just through communicating clearly and having patience with it, we always end up on the same page anyway.
Yeah.
Even if we started from a different space.
I love that. Yeah, I think that is so interesting because you started the product, right? Like you thought, and how long did you run it?
So Rob joined, started helping out. So 11 months, Rob started helping out on the side, just as a side project, just on a whim. He said he noticed something in one of my newsletters and he started helping out with building a machine learning model in November of 2019. And then he officially joined
in about a year.
February of 2019. But he'd been helping.
Well, and building and scaling StoryGraph as a sole developer in the early days is no easy feat. I'm just curious, like being both the sole developer and the CEO requires wearing multiple hats. How did you balance the technical aspects of the platform with the strategic responsibilities of leading the company?
So even today, if someone asks me, what's your main issue, pain point or for improvement that you think you could address? And I would say it's like spending my time wisely. And that can mean I'll have weeks. I have my own weekly retros as well. It's a great way of looking at, okay, you did not spend enough time on development, like actually product development. Is there a way that you can eke out more time? Is there something else you need to not be doing? So I would say, again, similarly for me, it's something I'm always asking every week because I think it also changes based on the season, based on what's happening. But I think my weekly reflection points, personal, these are just on my own, my personal reflection, because my personal reflections don't just cover work, they cover the rest of my life. And so that's a great way of checking, am I on the right track? Am I balancing? And if not, how do I rebalance it for next week or next month? Because I also do monthly retros for myself and I do my annual. And also my birthday's in September and I feel like it's a perfect time for, that's three quarters into the year. Mm. My birthday's end of September. So I always have we're now three quarters in, we've got a quarter left. What do we need to switch up for the final quarter? So I have all these checkpoints. So that helps. But I do think it's a trade-off ultimately still on a bunch of levels. One is it's a trade-off on speed. And the speed one goes both ways. Because in some ways, I can go really fast because it's just me. I don't have to worry about anyone else's code in the code base. I don't have to check with anyone. I don't need to review anybody else's code. Nobody needs to review my code. I could just put stuff out. on the flip side, I am still just one person. So I'm only ever doing one thing at a time. And so there are features like on our roadmap that have been there for years that I want to do, but I haven't done yet. Having said that, and either of you might have experience with this, either as a user or an investor. Even with companies with dozens of employees, there are things that customers ask for years and the company doesn't get around to it till years later. So I have to always remind myself of that. But there's also a trade-off of like, people think, oh, just hire someone. Then once you're paying someone like a decent salary, now you're going to be worrying about, okay, now I've got someone else's salary that I'm responsible for. And some money in the bank that can look like, oh, that's a decent amount of money. It's gone like that once you have one hire. And so there's another stress now that's on my head of like, not only is it everything else, now I've got someone else's salary. Now you have more pastoral and managerial roles as well. And there's that trade-off. Like I said, when you have more people, you know, they have like the whole pizza box thing or whatever it is. It's just the extra connections, the extra things you now need to deal with. And so I just choose, even though I have to wear many hats and it's not necessarily optimized, I'm not the best at the social media, I'm not the best developer, I'm not the fastest developer or whatever. It's working for us.
Yeah.
I think ultimately it's leading to our success. And I think so I'll take the social media as a great example. Yes, I'm not a social media expert. I just do what comes naturally and I post about the product. And on Instagram, we've grown to 115,000 users, nothing paid, nothing sponsored, just organic me showing up every day and just talking. And it's not just talking about the product. I am a reader. And so I really connected to our users being a reader because I am a reader with people about, there are a bunch of posts that's just me saying, I'm reading this book. This is what I think. And then people connect with me on that level. So yeah, it's a lot of different hats.
Yeah. Yeah, showing up as yourself. Yeah, I can imagine that actually resonates on like a social perspective. I was curious about fundraising. You, from what I understand, you didn't go the VC route. How did you think about fundraising?
My high level journey in terms of how I've seen VC is when I was younger, like in high school and university, I would follow things like TechCrunch, all those kind of stuff, Dealbook. And I would see these rounds of funding and think, wow, those people made it. That's so cool. I want to have that. Then you get older and you realize, no, raising a big does not mean you made it. Far from it. Now the real work starts and you're going to figure out how you're going to get your investors that money back. And I also heard a bunch of like scary stories of like, oh, the board fired the founder or all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, wow, that is wild. Like you could start a company and then you get investors and then they say, and I understand that obviously in some of these cases where the founder's been removed, it's because they're not actively helping the company. I understand it's not all just investors going rogue and because an investor wants their money back. So they wouldn't get rid of a founder if they didn't feel like they weren't the best person to run the company. But still, I had all these things in my mind and I remember thinking, I started moving more towards the bootstrapping. Like I just want to be able to build something, my own thing, make it profitable, be my own boss, not have to be accountable to anybody. And there was a period of my life where when I was getting into tech and I was in my first tech job before I ended up with the partnerships that I did, where I genuinely thought, you know what, I'm going to learn how to write Objective-C and then Swift. And I'm just going to be that developer that has a few iOS apps that just do really well and brings in like what would be a really good dev salary. And that's going to be my life and I'll be my own boss. And that was my idea originally. But then when I started Storygraph, as I explained, as it was growing, I was like, I cannot scale this manually because every book needs moods and pace and everyone needs a recommendation. So then I started thinking, I'm going to have to get investment because I don't have any co-founders around me. There's no one around me who has these skills. I'm going to need some machine learning capabilities. I'm going to need some other types of expertise that I don't have and that it would just be a bit mad for me to try and learn. And so I was thinking, oh, I'm going to be forced to get VC investment. And when I went to a couple of meetups and stuff, I kept hearing the same thing. This is not investable. There's Goodreads. You just whatever you do, Goodreads is going to copy you. It's just not investable. So I just was like, well, I'm just going to keep going. The funny thing is, obviously, I was very lucky. Rob came along. There's a funny story about that too. Because I was working with his wife before. We didn't speak for a while. We had reconnected. But the reason why Rob even got in touch was because he saw a newsletter that I posted on Twitter. So that's a whole other story of how he ended up working with me. But
So it was like cold.
Kind of. It was like a, hey, like long time. Yeah, long time no speak. Because originally when Sean and I weren't speaking for a little bit, I wasn't going to be speaking to her husband. So we had had a friendship, but obviously my main friendship was with Sarana. So when we weren't speaking for a little bit after the partnership didn't work out, I also stopped speaking to Rob because I just didn't feel it was appropriate. So then when we had reconnected, I didn't then immediately rush back to texting Rob. What happened was now we're on Twitter, like he's seen me on Twitter again and all this kind of stuff. And so he saw my old newsletters. And because I had posted all the ones up until that point, he went back and read them all. And the thing that he originally messaged me on was not about the help for the machine learning, which he'd just been learning on the side. It was because I had computer issues and he was telling me about, as opposed to Time Machine, being able to make a carbon copy clone backup, where then you can attach it to another computer and still be able to do your work. So that's how the conversation started. We were texting. Mm-hmm. We were like, let's just jump on a call. And during that call, he said, by the way, I've also noticed that you were struggling with this. And he was even hesitant to offer his help because he was like, I'm literally just learning this on the side. So I don't know if I'm going to do anything good, but maybe I can help. So that was that whole thing. But anyway, because Rob came along and was amazing and fit all the needs I had, I never needed to go back to that investment thing. And we're very staunchly now like, no, we're just bootstrapping. We don't need investment. And it's funny now, all the VCs that reach out every week, they're always like, no, this is great. We want to invest in this. And I'm like,
sorry.
Not now.
I love that. Now, one of the things you mentioned earlier, which I thought was super interesting, was just around how reflective you are personally, but also with your team. I'm just curious, like, how has your definition of success evolved since the platform's inception? And like, what are some of the key like metrics, milestones that you currently focus on? And how have they shifted over time?
That's a good question. I'm pausing because there are many different things at play, but also I know personally I am very ambitious and hard. In that people will look at what I've got now and go, you're successful. And I'm thinking, no, I'm not. I know I am, obviously. Like, going a books bootstrapped. This is like your standard freemium kind of thing that would need investment to get off the ground. And the fact that the money that I put in to bootstrap it and then Rob eventually put in, we've got that money back and we've got salaries, good salaries. Like, that is a great mark of success. So there was a period of time where it was just like, is anyone using this? So we would be looking at just user numbers and retention, that kind of stuff. And then it became, once we started spending thousands of dollars a month just keeping the app running, it was like, well, this isn't a sustainable business. So the marker of success became, how do we get to sustainability and profitability? And now we're there in terms of at this current setup, but it's kind of like, well, we see this as our life's work. So how do we set it up to get to that next level of sustainability mm-hmm. and profitability? For example, we're doing well, but if we did hire a developer now, then suddenly what looks like doing well is now like, oh, we need to make more money. So I think around focusing on like that long-term longevity and also cementing our spot as the main Goodreads alternative, because I would say right now we are, but there are other competitors out there and there are things that we fall down on. Another metric for me is I really want to make an app where the UX, UI and performance is stellar. And so a good metric is how often are people complaining either in support tickets or social media about things that fall under those branches. So a good sign of, oh, we're doing well on this is a reduction in tickets asking a question about how to do something or find something. And also people going, Storygraph is ugly or whatever. And so that is a more anecdotal. I mean, I guess I could count and tally per week, but roughly I'm keeping an eye on that. And that's something I'm really focusing on a lot now. So that's kind of product wise. Those are the main kind of things, the profitability, sustainability, and also the user experience, like mm-hmm. just being known. I just want us to be recognized as this app is a joy to use. It's a delight to use. It looks great. It's fast. Those kind of metrics, those kind of statements. And then, like, for example, we released a new look section for book reviews on the book page. Mm-hmm. And the stories that people were posting, this is so beautiful, I could cry. This is gorgeous. And I kept on sending them to the team and reposting some of them saying, this is what I want people to say about the whole app, not just this section. So we're on the right track. And then in terms of the team, I make sure that everyone's happy, that they're enjoying what they're doing. Yeah, and we're very, as much as I'm a very ambitious, hardworking person, I don't do deadlines. I don't like giving deadlines to people. It's kind of like you do them when you do them. And if there is a deadline externally, like for example, we have giveaways, the giveaways are starting on the 19th. So before the 19th, we need to do this.
Yeah.
Fine. But in general, I don't like deadlines for a bunch of reasons. I just want to make sure that people are happy, people are enjoying what they're doing. They don't feel like unnecessary pressure. And I guess this is mainly with Abby, who works with us. And now we've got a new designer, Yeji, who's a student in California, who's doing our design and helping us get to that vision that I have. And it's just been interesting, you know, figuring out with her, okay, I didn't give you a deadline, but it's now been 4 weeks and I haven't heard anything. So just having that conversation of like figuring out. And by the way, this is a great example of how just one extra person, and there's a lot of extra just kind of communication that now needs to happen that is me not doing development or anything else, which is good. But I mean, it's just that thing where people are like, just hire more people. It's not as straightforward. But anyway.
Changes the fabric of the business as you go on, the things you have to think about. But I think a key insight there that I'd like to flag is that success looks many different ways for a startup. And for you, you designed what that looks like for you. In your conversation and in measuring success, not once did you mention amounts raised. You talked about sustainability. You talked about your team loving what they do. You talked about the fact that people, customers or users who use the product love it. So I think it depends on, you know, whatever business, but making sure that you set what is success to you, because you might need to measure success differently.
I know that you experienced quite substantial growth over a period of time. You went from like 1,000 users to 20,000. Speaking specifically about consumer companies, like, when you experienced that sort of viral growth, how did you manage that sudden influx? What strategies did you kind of implement to support this growth? And then looking ahead, how have you consistently been able to engage that community?
So just to be clear, that 1,000 to 20,000 users was across 3 days. So it was 16th of June to 18th of June, something like that. So it was one of my hardest times in the company. And it was probably the closest I ever came to thinking, this company is going to die. And I can't do this. The closest I ever came to it, because I would like to stress that I didn't ever say I can't do this because I don't believe in that. So I just had to take a deep breath in terms of just mentally before even digging into the product. I just had to say to myself, Nadia, you are not the first person to have that's exploded. And you're not the first person. All the issues that are meaning the app is not working right now, someone else has had them before. So that kind of gave me the confidence to be like, you will find the answer, because this is not new. And I had a network of people online that I knew could help me if needed. So that was the one stage. And then essentially, each time we run into performance issues or bottlenecks or things like that, we first have to identify the problem. And then we need to re-architect or rewrite. And it's just a learning process of doing that. And so there are times when the app has been down or slow for periods of time, especially in the beginning of the year. And we just have to figure out, okay, what's the problem now? Because you sort one bottleneck and then you figure out the next one. And so that's just been continually doing that. And as you do that, one, the bottlenecks decrease, like as in because you've sorted out more. But two, the domain of what you're aware of what could be the issue increases. So you identify it faster, fix it faster, or maybe the fix is easier because you've already done the main fix and now you just need to increment a number or increment something. And so that just means you're down for longer when you do have issues. So that's the high level. And in terms of engaging the community, this is another thing. When we spoke about my many hats, I run our Instagram, Twitter, and Threads.
To this day.
Rob does TikTok. To this day, just me.
Incredible.
And so this, again, it's a lot of time, but it's so powerful in the narrative of the company. It's so powerful, especially for people who've been around for years, who are like, the founder is here. She talks with us. She's a reader. This app is built for readers, by readers. They feel a connection and they feel bought in. And because it's genuine. It's me being me. It's genuine. And I remember, even when the product, pre-product, when I was doing just community building, and then in the earliest days of the product, I remember saying to myself, if this product doesn't work out, I think I'm going to continue this account as like my personal books, because I felt a connection to the people I was talking books with. So I would say just continually buying them in, and then it has compounding effects. So I do polls a lot of the time. I do Instagram stories talking to people saying, this is what I'm working on, this is what happened. And you see over time, it buys us trust, it buys us time. So whenever I'm struggling or something hasn't come out for a while, everyone's like, oh, I know they're working hard. I know there must be a reason. Or people don't even notice. Sometimes I'm hard on myself because I'll say, wow, this thing took 6 weeks. This thing took 7 weeks. And then I have to remind myself, or somebody else reminds me, that Goodreads like never changes. And why I'm stressing myself out, just me being like, I haven't delivered anything in like weeks. And I'm like, Goodreads hasn't changed really much in the 2012 to 2020, that was 8 years. It's now like 13 years. So like, I'm still stuck on that 8 years because that's the 8 years I used it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's just continually showing up for the community every day and being transparent and being upfront. And that builds that relationship. And then as the relationship builds, it's easier to sustain because I feel like I'm in the habit of it.
I love that. And I think it's very clear, like when it comes to communities, people really do engage with people, right? And so being the face of it and people engaging directly with you is super powerful. And one of the reasons why you seem to have really resonated with your community.
Yeah, two quick points on that. One is it makes me chuckle every time I see someone post about our Instagram account and they'll say, it's a great account. And sometimes the founder comes on. I find that so funny because it's always me. So that's funny. The other thing is interesting is sometimes I'll get some rude messages and then I'll reply very politely and answer the question or whatever. And the number of people who go, oh, I didn't think anyone would reply to me. And it just goes to show that they have this anger, which cannot, the anger that they feel, we're a books app. I know it has to be coming from somewhere else because even if we were frustrating you because something didn't work, that the anger of which you sent this message, there must be something else happening. It can't solely be, to me, it can't solely be the book that annoyed you. But then clearly people just want to be heard because when they get a response, it's like, I did it. They sent it because they probably just thought I'm just getting out and it's a company. So they're probably not going to reply anyway. Hello.
And then like,
I just went, wow. And then and then the final one on that is when people assume that I'm only a social media manager person. So they'll say, can you pass this on or blah, blah, blah. Or they'll say like, wow, that worked. Or would you know this? And I'm like, yes, I do know because I'm the developer that's wild. So it's very fun and it definitely helps in terms of building that rapport and that brand trust and loyalty.
Amazing.
Thank you so much. I think we tend to go into reflective postures for the end of the episode. And we just want to go back in time to try to understand what you would tell yourself heading out into this journey. Everyone's journey is different, we know. But sometimes maybe the first principles from those experiences resonate to someone listening or watching. And then also any resources that you've particularly found helpful over time that has really moved the needle for you as a founder, helped you scale, helped you think of things differently.
I think I was very lucky to the parents I was born with, that they, despite their hardships and struggles, they instilled in me this can-do-anything attitude. And then I had some educators that continued that, particularly my economics teacher, Mr. Brewer. And then Rob is very much that speed of, you can do anything. His mom always used to tell him that, and he always told me that as well. So I think I would really tell myself, Nadia, you can do anything. You can do this. And just keep going. And remember, because I am very like, I've got to do it myself. I don't want to... In the earliest days of Storing Off, sometimes even with struggles where maybe there would be a friend who would be able to answer the question like that, I would feel like this is my company, this is my business. It says that these people have their own jobs and their own lives. I've got to figure this out. This, you know what I mean? But then it's realizing that, you know, you can lean on your network. You can ask people for help. And it doesn't mean they did the work or it doesn't... Friends, you know, I feel like I've continually put out good energy. So keep doing that. And I would say, don't be shy. I would tell myself, don't be shy to... reach out when you need a little bit of help. Those are the main things, but this main, like, you keep believing that you can do it because you can and you will. And then in terms of resources, I think
it could be books.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Podcast, good one.
It could be people.
I love How I Built This. Just hearing the variety of stories is amazing and inspiring. So I love the How I Built This podcast. That's a great one. I was thinking that this is more high level, just making you a better person, but it applies to being a better founder, a better team member. And that's the book Nonviolent Communication by Marshall B. Rosenberg. It just shows you a way to be able to express things that you're not happy with in a way that's productive and moves the conversation forward without the other person being defensive. A lot of how we communicate with people is violent. And you might be surprised when you're reading this book and you see the examples of what counts as violent. It could be implicit assumptions about something. So for example, saying You know, I'm disappointed as opposed to I'm sad. Saying I'm disappointed is violent because I am expressing the disappointment on you, and the other person's natural inclination is to feel hurt and attack. I disappointed you. Whereas if you said I'm sad because, now, first of all, that's just an internal feeling. And then you explain why you're sad. So it just breaks down this great way of communicating, which I think has put me in great stead just for all my relationships, but especially in a team. And I think founders can be more susceptible maybe to poor communication, especially in high stress situations. So I would recommend Marshall B. Rosenberg's Nonviolent Communication.
That's one that added to my list.
Also, I am someone who, I love reading narrative nonfiction that's filled with drama because my life is so drama free. So I would just for fun recommend Bad Blood by John Carreyrou and Hatching Twitter by Nick Bilton for examples of, like, you know, avoid these things, but have a fun startup story. And it's interesting. So yeah, those are just fun startup books.
Amazing.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much. It was so lovely to speak with you, Nadia.
Wow, Yvonne Maria, this was a real pleasure. Time flew by.
Thank you.
Leave a review. Tell us what you think of this episode on all of our platforms at the Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guests. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.